Welcome into another edition of the NBC Sports Pro Basketball Talk Podcast. I am Brett Polikoff. With me, as always, is Kurt Heelan. What is going on, Kurt?
Not much. You know, I'm adjusting to summer, which you think sounds like easy, but if you work from home and have kids and they're suddenly home, it changes.
Well, there's nothing changes on the East Coast. There's no summer. It's gray and rainy here. So, you know, it's pretty much, you know, I don't think you get more than 10 days of actually, like, what you would call, like, good or excellent weather out here. What's going on? We also have Dominic Ridgard of NBC Sports with us. What's going on, Dom?
Hey, Brett, how you doing, man? I feel your pain as a fellow East Coaster. It's like, rainy and humid at the same time. It's, like, the worst of both weather worlds right now.
Now, are you from the East Coast originally?
Yes, I am. From Boston.
Okay, so you're used to it, man. I've only been out here 2 years. I'm West Coast for life before that, so
wow.
It's been a little bit of a rough transition. Yeah.
No, I'm sure. Yeah, it's not easy to adjust to.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. But not as rough as the transition seems to be for David Blatt with the Cleveland Cavaliers. That's me and my expert segue there. So that's what we wanted to talk about here at the top is, you know, Cavaliers had season-ending media availability on Thursday. David Blatt and general manager David Griffin, you know, met with the media, and great timing for them to meet with the local media in Cleveland because, you know, shortly before they hit the podium, a report comes out from Mark Stein of ESPN.com, which basically says, you know, LeBron is disrespecting David Blatt. He's been doing it all season long. He did it in the finals, you know, in third quarter of game five, you know, Stein personally witnessed LeBron in the huddle, you know, shaking his head, you know, strongly, you know, in protest of a play Blatt was drawing up, and then Blatt, in front of the whole team, had to wipe the board clean and start over. So, you know, kind of a lot of nuance to this, right? I mean, the Cavaliers expect, they say, you know, David Blatt says, absolutely, I'm coming back to coach next season. David Griffin, the GM, seemed, you know, kind of annoyed at the negative storyline, considering that the Cavaliers did overachieve in overcoming injuries to make it to the finals and winning a couple games before eventually falling to the Warriors. So, Kurt, we'll start with you. How messed up is this situation in Cleveland between David Blatt and LeBron James? And, you know, can it continue like this?
I think it can. Look, I don't think it's good. I don't think this is the Tim Duncan-Greg Popovich relationship. I mean, there's always some tension, but even between those two. But I think the point about, like, him disrespecting the coach, that's something that's been kind of going off and on all season, and it's not just that, you know, the shaking the head and that play, you know, making him erase that play and you know, barking at him during the finals when he didn't like a substitution or a play call or something. I mean, if you go start to move back through the playoffs, remember that the game winner he hit in the corner where he made Blatt redraw that play because he was going to have Blatt was going to inbound have LeBron inbound the ball against Chicago. I think it was game four. Look, it's not that LeBron was wrong, saying, I shouldn't be inbounding the ball, I should be taking the shot. But it was afterwards, you know, when he went into the locker, you know, the media didn't know this. Like, the media didn't know that play had been redrawn. They didn't ask it. He volunteered that. He happily volunteered that to show his authority over the coach and kind of smack the coach around a little in public. And if you've been around LeBron, you know that he doesn't say he's really polished. Like, if he says something, it's intentional. It's not he doesn't let things just slip in the press. So he's done stuff like this all year where he says, you know, oh, I love Blatt, he's great, he's fine, he's my coach. He's just, you know, it's unfair, he's getting a hard time. Then he kind of secretly just kind of passive-aggressively kind of smacks him around. I don't think it's a great relationship. I also don't think Blatt's going anywhere. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One is there's reports that the owner, Dan Gilbert, is like Blatt's biggest supporter in the organization. B, look, if he's gone, it's clearly on LeBron. Like, it's not on anybody else. The blood is on LeBron's hands, and that's just, like, he doesn't do that. He doesn't dirty himself that way.
No, I completely agree. And it's funny, I always go back to that shot that he made, and it's like the press conference was in Chicago. The press conference was real weird because it's like he goes, well, the coach, the play coach drew up. He goes, I scratched it. And he kind of like smiles and nods his head, like waiting for the media to like do this big like moment. And everybody kind of stared at him blankly, and he realized he had to kind of move on quickly. It was one of those things where it's like, well, if you missed the shot, would you have offered up that information if you didn't knock it down? Like, clearly, we'll never know that. And this whole situation, it reminds me of that famous Will Ferrell line where he goes, "Wow, that escalated quickly." Like, we knew that they didn't get along, but it's like what's coming out now was like LeBron basically couldn't stand the guy, like almost as if he was completely dismissive of everything he brought up. And it's funny how quickly, at least how I feel, how it's starting to turn, is that at first I thought it was a huge indictment on David Blatt that, you know, he really didn't stand his ground and he was kind of getting pushed around. But now it's starting to turn like, wow, LeBron's kind of being a jerk to this coach almost unnecessarily, or to the point where it's so blatantly disrespectful that even his greatness can't supersede how badly he's treating his coach.
Well, part of this, I think, in any relationship, right, it's both parties' fault if it doesn't work out. So part of this, to me, is on David Blatt. And Kurt, you've been around him. And in fact, I was looking back because, you know, Summer League announced their schedule, and they're going to have the top two picks in the draft. You know, Minnesota and the Lakers, they're going to be playing each other on the first day of the tournament. So that reminded me of last summer, where we had the exact same thing. We had the Cavaliers when Andrew Wiggins was still on the team, and, you know, against the Bucks and Jabari Parker. And David Blatt was coaching the Summer League team, so that was kind of our first opportunity during Summer League to sort of get to know him. And, you know, while he's affable to a point in speaking with the media, it's clear that he likes to be the smartest guy in the room when he's talking to you. Like, he makes that known that, hey, I'm smarter than you. He talks down a little bit in a little bit of a condescending way. And I don't know if it's intentional or not, or just because he is a really smart guy, you know, and he's been around a long time. But if he came into the Cavaliers and LeBron James with that attitude at the beginning of the season, with that kind of type of level of confidence, you know, that could have easily rubbed LeBron the wrong way. So partly it's on Blatt, but, you know, I look at the way, one of the reasons LeBron James came back to the Cavaliers was to have the amount of power that he has in this organization. As long as Pat Riley is running the Miami Heat, LeBron was never going to have say in personnel matters, in coaching decisions, in nothing. You know, there's no way Pat Riley is going to listen to a player, you know, over his own experience. Coming back to the Cavaliers, LeBron knew it was going to be his world. He was going to be able to do whatever he wanted. He could dictate the terms of a coaching hire or not. You know, he could sit it out. He could stay on the sidelines. And then Kurt, as you mentioned, he could avoid culpability, you know, on an issue if you say, hey, you know, that's on ownership, that's on the coach, that's on the GM. So it's very interesting. I think right now it appears as though David Blatt is coming back, but LeBron James can opt out and become a free agent this summer. And, you know, he'll probably structure his contract so that that's the case for at least the next couple of years. That puts a lot of pressure on the organization to make the right decision. And let's be honest, all LeBron has to do is make one phone call into ownership and say, if Blatt's back next year, I'm not. And then the head coach is gone.
Absolutely. Look, you're right. You're completely right about the power thing. By the way, you are spot on about Blatt. Blatt, actually, I've gotten along really well with him, but he also comes from that European system, and he will be more than happy to tell you about his success in Europe and remind everyone.
Right, exactly.
But you got to remember, for people who don't know this, the European system is, in a lot of ways, more like the college system here, where the coach is the guy with all the power. I mean, all the power. He can just have you booted off the team in no time. It's also a very different, and Blatt admitted it was really an adjustment for him this year, getting used to the NBA in a way he didn't, you know, expect. But it's because of the star system. I mean, you think about the European game. Who was the best European player to come over this past season into the NBA? It was Mirotić, with the Bulls guy, rookie who was in the Rookie of the Year running. And he's what, the fourth best guy on that team? Fifth, sixth? I mean, he was playing a sixth-man role. The elite players in Europe are there. Like the top, you know, I had a scout once tell me, like, the top 150 players in the NBA are just better than most of the guys in Europe. If they're a really good European player, a Dirk or a Power or a Marc Gasol or somebody, they're already over here, you know? So with that flat talent pool, the coach has this power, and he has to win by system more than he necessarily has to win by just having LeBron or Kevin Durant or whoever on the team. And I think he just, he's like, it's going to be the same. It's still basketball. I'm going to come over here, and these guys are all going to follow my system. And he was just not fully prepared for what was going to be coming his way. And I think to his credit, he adjusted pretty well by midseason to the, well, if I have to keep my job, then I've got to kind of just do what LeBron says and go along with this and try to work what I want to do around that, because the offensive system wasn't working because LeBron wasn't buying in and Kyrie wasn't buying in. I think he adjusted to that somewhat, and I think LeBron may have reached a, I think I used the word detente when I was writing it, like a, all right, I can live with this. But LeBron's guy is sitting on that bench. LeBron, like many players who have played for with him, love Tyronn Lue, love him. And that's the problem for Blatt, is that his successor and the guy with LeBron's backing sits, you know, two chairs down.
Yeah, I think Windhorse, I think he was on one of the ESPN either radio or TV shows, and he basically said, another tough thing for Blatt is you beat out Tyronn Lue for the head coaching job, and then they hire him to be your head assistant. And yeah, it's like, so you're basically sitting there with your successor to your right, and there's already reports saying that he calls plays, that he calls timeouts, that LeBron will huddle up with just Tyronn Lue and like look at everybody else but David Blatt. You know, they really, it's funny because Blatt, I feel like, is in a complete lose-lose, and LeBron, like we've mentioned, the savvy businessman that he is, has put himself in a complete win-win. You know, it's like you say, you know, LeBron's got he went back to Cleveland to get all this power, which he does have, but it's also like, and I don't mean to diminish what he has to do, LeBron, obviously, like, he's such a great player, but it's like you have all this power, but I feel like he doesn't necessarily have all the, he found a way to get all the power and kind of void all the responsibility that can come with it at times. You know, like, they always say, well, who's really coaching that team? Well, when they're winning, it's LeBron, and when they're losing, it's Blatt. You know, who's making these personnel decisions? Well, when J.R. Smith's hitting 8 threes a game, ESPN's running features on how LeBron's the one that pushed for him to come, and LeBron's telling him to be himself, and now J.R. Smith's found this awesome role. And when he's terrible in the finals, you know, that just fizzles away, and it wasn't LeBron's call to bring him in anymore. But so, and I know he's got tons of on-the-court responsibility. He's an amazing player, and I think that if we get a couple years down the line and LeBron still hasn't brought a title to Cleveland, that's when the stove will get hot again. But at least in the short term, you know, the guy's in a complete win-win, and he's put his coach in a complete lose-lose situation.
Yeah, it's certainly a selective amount of power that he has, right? I mean, he can choose to exercise it whenever he wants. We've seen in a couple of the other stories that, you know, a couple of past summers, LeBron just didn't pick up his phone. He wasn't reachable. So when the team tried to reach out to him to make decisions, whether it's on free agency, coaching, what's going to happen, are you coming back next season, he just goes radio silent. Nobody can get a hold of him. And you're forced to guess, you know, sort of what he wants. So,
yeah,
you're right. He's definitely in a pretty nice situation, having that ability to sort of control or not control his destiny.
He literally told the Heat who to draft and then left. Didn't he
tell him who to draft via Twitter, though?
He said Shabazz Napier was his favorite player in the draft by far, and the Heat take him, and then he bounces.
Yeah, that's on the Heat, though, man. That's ridiculous.
Oh, I agree. Ridiculous. But, you know, it's also one of those things where it's like, you know, he's going to be a free agent. LeBron's sending these, you know, kind of cryptid, not so cryptid messages via social media, which he's done before. We've seen it. We saw him do it this year. And, you know, and reports have come out, at least recently, that it was more of a stare down than we realized between him and guys like Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra. That was one where they seeded, thinking hopefully this can help our position again. Like you said, it's completely on them. LeBron didn't do anything wrong. It's not like he did anything illegal. It's just funny to look at that scenario, how it played out in hindsight. It'd be like, wow, he kind of played you guys.
You know, I mean, I'm curious. Looking forward, we're talking about this power. Where is LeBron now on Kevin Love. Because, I mean, he was the guy who pushed for using Wiggins for Love. I mean, there was a lot of hesitancy within the Cavaliers organization. They had the number one pick, and Wiggins is, you know, look, he developed, frankly, faster than most people, myself included, thought he would this past year. His offensive game, his jump shot came along way faster. That guy looks like he could end up being pretty special. Now you've got Love, who's got a mind of his own, but if you're LeBron now, where are you on the Love thing? Do you want Love back after the way Tristan Thompson, who, by the way, has the exact same agent as you, mm-hmm. Do you want him back? I mean, I think you're going to push to get him back for a year, but both Love and LeBron are going to opt out and then sign, you know, two-year deals with an opt-out after one so they can get some of that TV revenue next year. I'm curious where that goes, because if Love leaves, and I don't think he is this summer, but if Love leaves, that's a blunder by LeBron. I mean, that's a blunder, because you've given up the number one pick and gotten to rent a player for a year.
Yeah, but like I said, how much blame will be shot his way? You know what I mean? If Love moves on, will we conveniently forget that he's the one that wrote that letter and left Bennett and Wiggins out because he knew that he was going to try and move them both to get Kevin Love, and he knew that, like, everybody, it's a consensus among people that follow the NBA that he knew that deal was on the table, like the whole Cavs organization did. So,
yeah,
you know, what kind of blame gets thrown his way if they gave up a number one pick and a potential all-star like Andrew Wiggins looks like he's going to be for Kevin Love for 2 years, especially if they don't win it all next year?
No, I said this at the time of the trade. If you're the Cavaliers, you have to make that deal because you're getting LeBron James in his prime, and you need to. If all stars are available to surround him with, you give up number one picks, you give up the future to try to win a championship now. Cleveland's never won a championship. It's desperation time. You have the best player in the world on your team in his prime. You make that deal. But that being said, I also said at the time, if the Cavaliers don't win a championship with Kevin Love and LeBron James in place, and it's a huge bust. You gave up Andrew Wiggins, who, like, you know, we've seen. He was sensational his rookie year. His athleticism is off the charts. He's going to be an all-star for years to come. You know, Kurt, as far as Kevin Love goes, you said, you know, does LeBron want him back? I think we all expect LeBron to have the same contract that he had this season, which is a max for next season with a player option for the year after that. If Kevin Love signs up for the same type of deal, I think he's back next season. The question becomes, what if Kevin Love decides, look, I want to lock in some long-term financial flexibility now. I want a five-year deal, you know, at or near the max. Then what do the Cavaliers do? At that point, it becomes an extremely interesting decision because you got to the finals with Love injured, playing a completely different identity with Tristan Thompson in the starting lineup, much more defense and rebound-oriented. And you got, you know, you won two games in the NBA Finals by playing that way. You bring Kevin Love back, it's a completely different dynamic. That's a huge decision for the organization to make, whether they want to make that type of commitment. I think that's what is going to be the biggest factor in Love returning, is what kind of contract he's looking for.
Well, I think there's a couple parts to that. I've thought for a while that he's going to do just like I said, and like we were talking about, he's going to get the opt-out after next year. And if he left, then he's going to look for, like, under that new cap deal, he's going to look for the security. He's going to bide his time for a year, get the extra cash that will come in, and then get the, you know, 5 year if he stays, 4 years if he goes, you know, max deal wherever. And if he leaves, that would be the timing to me. But I think your point is a good one. The thing is, it becomes more interesting too. If he asks for 5 years this year, you know, we're going to see some max contracts this summer. You know, somebody like Chris Middleton's going to get max or near max. Tristan Thompson's going to get max or near max.
Just sounds crazy to say.
What?
It sounds crazy to say, but you're right.
But part of that is because the cap is spiking, teams are going to go, we like this player. And by the way, this deal isn't going to look as bad in a few years because its percent, you know, it goes from being 25% of the salary cap to a much smaller percentage within 2 years. If the salary cap bumps up north of $100 million in a couple of years, suddenly that $17 million, $18 million doesn't look as bad percentage wise on your books. If Love asks for, if Love actually were willing to take that, I think the Cavs would take it, even if they tried to move him afterwards or decided to, just because, again, that in 4 or 5 years, that could be valuable. That could be a value contract.
Yeah, and the thing, it's funny. I think there was a shift with Kevin Love where at first he was kind of getting rigged over the coals a little bit for how much his numbers fell off and how much he wasn't producing. And it started off kind of that was, you know, the blame kind of shifted. It started off that was his fault. And again, it kind of ties back to David Blatt. And then the narrative started to change where, well, they're just not using him correctly. You know, it looked awkward just watching a guy who averaged 24 and 12 basically stand in the corner and become James Jones. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it almost like his value kind of buoyed, like it kind of dipped. And then once that narrative started, well, they're not using him correctly, it started to spike again. So I think that he's definitely going to take the 2 year with an option. When he opts out, he's going to take the 2 year with a player option for the next year, because I think he realizes that his value is still at max level. So when you know that the cap is going to spike, which I'm sure obviously he and his agents do, they know that his barring another injury, which we all hope doesn't happen, his value will still be towards the max. And once that changes to 25% of a, what is it, $70 million cap to a $100 million cap, he'll stand to make a lot more money in the future.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I'm you know, I wonder what Kevin Love thinks of David Blatt.
Yeah, that's a whole other question.
Well, one more thing on David Blatt before we, you know, start to sort of move on here is, let's not forget that he wasn't hired to do the job that he ended up getting.
No,
I mean, he was hired by the Cavaliers before LeBron James committed. In fact, the news broke of that when we were at Summer League, when he was coaching Andrew Wiggins. You know, the news broke that LeBron was going to come back to the Cavaliers. So, you know, he was hired to basically be a confident guy with success to lead a young team led by Kyrie Irving, you know, snap Deion Waiters into shape, play with Anderson Varejao, and mold Andrew Wiggins as a rookie, and also, let's not forget, Anthony Bennett, you know, the number one pick of the previous season. That was the job that Blatt was hired to do. He was hired to basically bring the Cavaliers, you know, drag them into the playoffs, which in the Eastern Conference isn't that hard because you get to be under 500 and still make it. That's what he was hired to do. What he ended up having to do was coach LeBron James,
yeah,
Kevin Love, and, you know, trying to win a championship with that team. So I think, honestly, under the circumstances, taking this Cavaliers team with the injuries to 2 wins in the NBA Finals, I think he overachieved. I think he did a good job with the learning curve. And most importantly, despite the perceived slights that we're all viewing from the outside, he learned to coexist with LeBron James. And I think that's the most important thing when sort of evaluating Blatt's first season.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
I agree that there seems to be, they seem to have worked out a you know, I can live with this peaceable solution for now that LeBron can live with and Blatt can live with, and that they're going to, you know, this is going to be how it goes for a couple years. And frankly, as long as they're winning, as long as there's some success, and I think considering it's their first year and they made it to the finals and all the injuries, this year has to be considered a success. And something they can build on. I don't think this goes anywhere. It'll be interesting to see if Blatt is able to, in next year, look, you know, the offense he wants to install, what he would prefer to run, looks a whole lot like what Golden State ran, or what smoked LeBron the year before in the finals with San Antonio. It'd be curious to see if he's able to get some of that in. It's never going to be pure, just because LeBron and Kyrie don't want it that way, but I'm curious if he's going to be able to insert some of that into the offense, because it would certainly help. I mean, just some of that player movement, some of that getting guys off the weak side moving and using them as a threat would help LeBron find space in the offense.
All right,
so before we move on, go ahead.
I just want to have one quick thing, you know, and you mentioned it, Brett, you know, like the perceived slights in their relationship now and what it could, how we're viewing it. It does bear a small resemblance to how that first year was in Miami with Eric Spoelstra. And, you know, we saw the I think that they were losing one game, and he did like the bump into Spoelstra, and we blew that up. We blew that up too.
That's right.
You know, was that situation, I guess, worse, or is it worse with David Blatt? Are they very similar, and we're just kind of blowing it up because it's in the now? Do we still have to wait a little bit to see? I mean, you did mention that Spoelstra at least had Pat Riley's backing, and he was the figurehead in that organization. Are we just seeing history repeat itself, and then eventually, like Kurt, you said, if they start winning, it'll all kind of wash away and be water under the bridge?
Yeah, I think you nailed it, and Brett said it earlier. The big difference in that in the situations is simply Pat Riley, and who has the power. Riley would not have. Spoelstra was his guy, you know. And like we said, it doesn't. You know, Dan Gilbert may love the owner, may love, you know, David Blatt. If, like you said, if LeBron calls up and says he's gone. Like, look, he has the power to absolutely get David Blatt fired. I just don't think he wants to do it because everybody knows it would be him.
Yeah, it's like the magic.
Well, not only Pat Riley in Miami, but let's not forget, you know, Dwayne Wade.
Yes.
You know, was already there. He was the face of the Miami Heat. You know, LeBron James joined a team that already had an identity with Dwayne Wade. You know, Eric Spoelstra already in place. That's very different than quote unquote coming home to the Cavaliers. You know, being, you know, basically parades are being thrown, rallies are, you know, pep rallies are happening. You know, as soon as you make the announcement, remember during the news with all those people like camping outside his house.
Yeah.
when that was great. Like, it's just so ridiculous to me. Like, he doesn't, you know, he wasn't there. He was like in Las Vegas or wherever. And just everybody in Cleveland just drives to his street and just kind of hangs out, waits for things to happen. But I just think that it was a very different situation coming home to Cleveland. So, you know, LeBron, as we mentioned, he has the power in the organization. If he wants Black gone, he's gone. But I kind of agree with Kurt. I don't think he's going to lean that way just yet. You know, if things start to go south for some reason next year, you know, that'll be a different story. All right, well, let's sort of move ahead here. We're 6 days away from the NBA draft on next Thursday, June 25th. We're not going to go too deep on this one. We'll have a deeper preview on the draft and some of the prospects for you guys next week. But wanted to take a look at the top three teams and what we think that they might do. So Minnesota Timberwolves are the number one overall pick. You know, most people are projecting Karl Anthony Towns to be, you know, most deserving of that slot. However, you know, Flip Saunders has been, you know, said to have been, you know, fairly enamored with Jahlil Okafor, but it seems as though one of those two guys will go top two. So then you look at the Lakers, you know, theoretically they should just grab whichever big man is still on the board. Both of those guys seem to be fine choices, could be star-level talents for years to come in the league. It would be low risk to take one of those two guys. However, you know, Lakers had a second workout with Emmanuel Mudiay, who played in China last season, you know, sort of an intriguing point guard, athletic, big, you know, strong prospect. So they may be taking a hard look at him. D'Angelo Russell out of Ohio State, another point guard who's projected to be, you know, worthy of top three talent. So possibility Lakers can go in another direction. But guys, here's where it gets interesting. So for weeks now, it's been Towns, Okafor, and D'Angelo Russell projected to go in some order in the top three of the NBA draft. A couple of the most credible mock drafts out there right now have the international big man Kristaps Porzingis falling to the Sixers now at three. They're saying Sam Hinkie likes him. Hinkie always good, best available talent, regardless of the fact that they have Nerlens Noel and Joel Embiid. You know, they're loaded with bigs and they need a guard. People have Hinkie liking Porzingis. So just want to talk to you guys, get your thoughts. What do we think? How do we think the top three picks of the draft are going to shake out? And then we'll look at, you know, potentially how that could affect, you know, the way the rest of the dominoes might fall.
Yeah, because it gets really interesting if you know, the wild card has always been Phil Jackson at four, who has certain guys he likes but is with the Knicks, but is willing to trade out of that. Porzingis isn't apparently on his list of guys he wants, but if they're really going to take Porzingis with Philadelphia, then, you know, somebody like Okafor or Russell is going to fall to him. I will say this. I heard when I was around with the finals and with people from the league, the buzz now is that after seeing him in person, Flip Saunders has come over to the Karl Anthony Towns side. He went and watched a workout out in the Los Angeles area with him and kind of came back, and his whole staff was like, Towns, Towns, Towns. So he went and watched a workout and came back and said, yeah, I can see that. So I think Towns going number one is really likely. Not impossible that they go with Okafor, but really likely it's Towns. And that puts the Lakers in an interesting situation, like you said. I think they're still going to take Okafor, but they reportedly really liked Russell. You know, they liked Russell in the workout. Porzingis intrigued them. I'm curious what direction they're going to go. My guess is that they're going to go Okafor, and then we're up to Sam Hinkie, and I hate trying to predict what he's going to do. But, I mean, is he saying Porzingis because everybody knows Orlando loves him at five?
Right,
and
exactly.
Does he really want Russell? Because that was the early rumor, that they really wanted Russell to fall to them. That was the guy that they pictured as the next, you know, look, they've got Joel Embiid and Nerlens Noel up front. Although,
hopefully they've Embiid.
Yeah, well, I was about to say, they thought they had Joel Embiid, and that could be part of it. But the other part of that is Hinkie certainly is a guy who couldn't care less about position. He's going to just collect assets and collect talent and move that around as needed and trade guys or do whatever to get the pieces he wants. And if he really thinks Porzingis is the guy, and there are certainly scouts out there who think Porzingis is going to be the best guy out of this draft, then he might just take him anyway. And so is he trying to do this as a smokescreen, or is he genuinely serious about taking him?
Yeah, that's the tough thing with any draft, specifically the NBA and the NFL. There's so much lying that goes on because they're trying to push one prospect up because they don't want to take him, or they're trying to push one prospect down because they're hoping they fall to him. It's kind of funny. Like, you're seeing, like, we talked about how much the Wolves got enamored with Towns after their workout. I still saw, you know, reports that, you know, they might even like Kristaps Porzingis at one. It's like, that's not happening. Like, why would you even, you know, like, you're compelled to report what you hear, obviously, but it's like, as viewers and consumers, we have to weed out the smoke screen. So, you know, I think it's obvious 1-2 is going to be Towns Okafor. I think that with Towns is the best player in the draft, in my opinion, just watching college basketball. And I think the Lakers are still going to build from a traditional model with prioritizing a big man, maybe still kind of haphazardly wanting to kind of get into this new era of basketball. They're still trying to avoid that. I think they're going to try and build with a Jahlil Okafor from the front and move backwards. So, like you guys have been saying, Philly's kind of the one that's kind of that could throw a wrench in the rest of the draft. And Sam Hinkie, it's frustrating to kind of see how they're doing this slow build, but you still feel like you're not getting anywhere with the team. You know, it feels like they've been tanking for like 4 years now. It feels that way because that's the truth, I guess. But they need it. I feel like they need a piece that's not like, okay, this project that we're hoping to develop. You know, it was the same way with Nerlens Noel when they took him. He was clearly, even before he tore his ACL, I thought he was the most athletic player in the draft with the highest defensive upside. The same thing with Joel Embiid. It was, you know, we see the makings of this guy that could be really good. At some point, they have to take someone who they think is fairly polished and will reach their potential sooner rather than later. And I think that's D'Angelo Russell. I think he's the kind of guy that could come in right away, be your starting point guard, and could be a leader on the team right away. So that's who I think they should take. I think they're leaning towards taking him. I think he did. There were rumors, or it was reported that he canceled his first workout, and a lot of people were saying, "Well, yeah, because he's trying to avoid Philadelphia." Turns out that he really was sick. He did his workout with Philly, and reports are that he did really well. You know, I think this is a big decision for Hinkie because you can only push decisions into the future for so long before people get hip and are like, this is ridiculous. You got to start making decisions to start winning games sooner rather than later. You can't take a redshirt year on Noel, a redshirt year on Embiid, possibly two. Can't draft Dario Saric, who's going to come over in 2 years, and basically keep tanking for 4 or 5 years in a row. You have to start making decisions to win games, not just build assets. And if he drafts Porzingis and it turns out that he's not that he's not as good as people expect, or it's going to take a lot longer, and they go another year being in the bottom barrel of the Eastern Conference, I could see the guy losing his job. I don't think Brett Brown is, because he's a good coach, but, you know, I think this is a big decision for Hinkie, and I think he should take Russell for sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, as far as losing his job and all that, you know, ownership has to be on board with this type of rebuilding model, with one that's going to last several seasons. So, you know, all the ownership has to do is say, look, enough of the nonsense, drop somebody that's going to play now, and he'll have to do it, and he'll have to go in that direction.
Yeah.
And I agree with D'Angelo Russell for the Sixers. I think you can't bail on Michael Carter Williams the way you did. You know, reigning rookie of the year, you trade him for spare parts because you really wanted that protected lottery pick from the Lakers. You know, Carter Williams, we saw in the playoffs, and we saw once he got to Milwaukee, yeah, the guy may not be able to shoot the three right now, but he's still capable of putting up 30 points. You know,
yeah.
We saw him do that with the Milwaukee Bucks.
For sure.
So, you know, Hinkie has said he values shooting. He values three-point shooting. That's D'Angelo Russell. He's proven he can hit that shot. I think that's a guy you have to upgrade that position. You have to look at the fact that they have bigs in Noel and theoretically Embiid at some point. You have guys that can produce at on a low block and, you know, defend inside. You need to add scoring from the point guard or from the wing position. I think Russell's the way to go. I think if they do end up with Porzingis, it's going to be extremely interesting. And as far as Lakers go, you know, Mitch Kupchak has said he believes it's easier to add point guard and wing talent than it is dominant big men. So I expect them to go with whoever is left over between Okafor and Towns.
Yeah, and look, I saw Okafor for the first time at Adidas Nations, actually, years ago. I was sitting there next to Jonathan Jonathan from Draft Express and some people, and we're like, I'm watching his footwork. This is the year before he goes into his senior year of high school, and I'm like, his footwork's amazing, and people around us were like, yeah, I think he's better than about half the NBA bigs right now. That guy, Okafor, is going – he has really polished moves, and he's going to come in and score. I expect him to be rookie of the year, to be honest with you. I expect him to come in, especially if he's somewhere like the Lakers, where he's going to get touches.
And be on national TV.
Yeah, exactly. I think he's the rookie of the year because he's going to come in and put up numbers. I don't think he's better than Towns 3 years from now. But he's going to come in, and you know, the concern is everything else, that he ultimately becomes – I mean, the concern is he's some version of Carmelo Anthony in the sense that he brings you a ton of offense, but he doesn't do, you know, anything. You know, he doesn't bring you the other things you need to win. I'm not sure – you know, I don't want to pigeonhole him like that, but I think, look, at the end of the day – the name of the game is putting the ball in the basket. And if you can get a guy who can do that with that kind of skill level, I think you take him. And I think his defense, look, he wasn't asked to play defense at Duke. In fact, he was told stay out of foul trouble on a team with Justice Winslow and all these guys who were going to go, you know, in the lottery. The offense ran through Okafor. They asked him to pass out of there. They asked him to do all this stuff. He was the complete fulcrum of an offense that's got like three or four NBA players on it. So, I think you have to take him number two if you're the Lakers.
Yeah, definitely going to be interesting to see how this all shakes out. See if we get a bunch of draft night trades, you know, as things get going.
Because there's a lot of that.
Yeah, and once you get past the top three, you know, we'll get into it, you know, later next week as the draft gets closer, but especially the Knicks at four, you know, what do they do if Towns, Okafor, and Russell are all off the board? You know, do they go with Moutier or do they trade down, try to get some veteran help in addition to a guy they want? You know, Trey Lyles is the name that came up, but they wouldn't have to take him anywhere near, you know, the top 10. So it becomes very interesting after those, you know, top three picks.
Well, it becomes really interesting, assuming it goes Towns, Okafor, Russell, in whatever order. It becomes really interesting because there's teams that do love Porzingis, and there's a team willing to trade at four, and you know he's not. You know Porzingis is getting taken at five by Orlando, and suddenly, you know, it becomes really interesting. Is there a team willing to jump up and do it? Is there a team willing to throw the Knicks what they want to get into that slot?
Yeah, New York is very open to taking on players that can help them now. You know, Phil Jackson, you know, I don't want to say he's 100 years old, but he's basically like 70 years old. He's not.
Getting close.
The likelihood of him sticking around, you know, for all 5 years of his contract, you know, to run this team and to complete a lengthy rebuild, it's very unlikely. So he's going to be more than open to taking on some immediate talent that can help this team get back to the playoffs next season. And if that involves trading down and getting a nice prospect that, you know, the Knicks brain trust believes can help them keep a little bit this year and maybe evolve into something great, I think it's very likely that we see the Knicks make a draft night trade.
I got a quick question. You know, and I heard it on our corporate colleagues' radio show, Dan Patrick. He was talking about this concept of the overseas players and how they get so much hype and they shoot up draft boards every year. And a lot of it's because, you know, we get enamored with the unknown. We get enamored with these names and we can only get so much of what they show us. You know, we can watch these college players play every single one of their games. It's not that easy to do with the players that play overseas. Like, who was the last overseas player that really kind of lived up to the draft day hype surrounding them? You know, I feel like it happens every year. I think last year it was Dante Exum, where it was like, this guy's amazing, you know, like how, like 6'6" point guard, like he's gonna come in and like run an offense right away. And I watched him in Utah and like, yeah, there's things there that he's really good at, but it's like, if he played in at like a Kansas or a Duke, I don't think he would have gotten nearly the hype that he got just because we couldn't really watch him play that much. And it's so predictable. You're seeing it happen with Porzingis right now. He was just the name that people say, yeah, like, look out for this guy. He's going to be good. Like, he's really picking up steam. And now we're talking about him being picked third and fourth in the draft. It's like, it's kind of amazing that I don't want to call it a trap because some of these guys do end up really good, but we fall into the same cycle every year. It's like the history keeps repeating itself.
I don't think he's Bargnani. I don't know how good he's going to be, but we can be fair there.
Well, what I hear on these international guys, and I think teams are starting to get wise to this a little bit, is that a lot of these guys, if they're tall and have some sort of semblance of athleticism, they get forced into playing basketball at a very young age, and it sort of becomes a career, you know, while they're, you know, still in the early stages of their grade school years. And a lot of guys don't have that hunger to play it. They just kind of got thrown into it. Yeah. And it's a path to money and, you know, a little bit of success, but it's not their passion. And so I think that's what we've seen with a lot of the international guys in the past, is that they just simply haven't had that hunger. Supposedly it's different with Porzingis. You know, obviously we'll see how it plays out as the years goes on. But I think that's been the biggest factor in the international guys maybe not panning out. Of course, there's that level of intrigue, which like, ooh, maybe he is better than some of these college guys. But, you know, more than anything, that's why the interview is so important. You need to find out which of these guys, if any of them, have that Chris Paul, Kobe Bryant level of fire that they're going to just bust their ass and make sure that winning is the priority night after night, year after year, you know, for years to come.
That's actually, I think big men not loving the game, it's not just a European thing. I mean, you, whether it's Andrew Bynum out here or a host of other guys, look, if you don't love the game and short, quote unquote, but I mean average size by NBA standards, if you're 6'4", 6'5", there's a whole host of guys who will outwork you, who want to be there, who like the game, who are doing this for different reasons, but there just aren't. Look, there's a really small pool of mobile, athletic guys who are 6'10", to, you know, 7 foot, and it's easy to kind of like coast through and get, you know, at least get a college degree or whatever.
All right, so definitely be interesting to see how that all shakes out. Well, right after the draft, July 1st, we have free agency beginning. So even though the regular season or the playoffs just ended with the Warriors winning the championship, this is basically the busiest time of the year for NBA news, rumors, you know, trades, free agent acquisitions. It starts to get crazy. So, you know, obviously we talked about LeBron James and Kevin Love. They'll both be able to be free agents. But let's look at, you know, sort of the other biggest name on the board. You know, we'll have plenty of time to get into everybody, you know, as we get deeper here into the summer. But real quick, just because we had a report emerge yesterday from Adrian Wojnarowski of Yahoo Sports, you know, Marc Gasol is quote-unquote expected to stay with the Memphis Grizzlies. So I think we all sort of see that as the most likely outcome. You know, Marc Gasol has been in Memphis since he was in high school when Pau Gasol was there. You know, his role there is good. The Grizzlies are a perennial contender. And, of course, Memphis can offer him an additional year on a max contract one more year than any other team has to offer. So, Kurt, what do you think? I mean, I think we all sort of expected this, but does this latest report sort of seal the deal for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only team I had heard, the only team that intrigued him potentially, he was Marc Gasol's personality is such that he's not going to hunt out the Lakers or the Knicks or that kind of spotlight, even though they both love to have him. That's not his style. The team that might have intrigued him is San Antonio if Tim Duncan walked. And that's not official either way yet, but the sense is that Duncan is coming back now. I heard around the finals that he's reached out to his trainer and he's kind of started his workouts again. Like, you don't start working out in June to get ready for bathing suit season.
Right.
You know, if you're going to workouts in June, you're prepping for next season. So, my guess is probably just one more. But if he's coming back, they can't bring anybody in really anyway. So, if that's not there, I can't see any way he leaves Memphis. Now, LaMarcus Aldridge, on the other hand,
right? Yeah, those seem to be the two names that that are kind of the hot. They were like pseudo free agents at first. Like, are they really free agents? And then reports kind of came out that like, no, you could actually lure these guys away. Now it seems like Marc Gasol's probably pretty entrenched in Memphis. And you know, the LaMarcus Aldridge thing is really interesting to me because, you know, it started off saying, and I know we talked about it, Kurt, a little bit. Like, he actually has a solid footprint in Portland in that organization as far as like the players that played there and what they accomplished. You know, there really aren't that many names in that organization besides probably, you know, Bill Walton and Clyde Drexler that are kind of more recognizable names as Portland Trailblazers in that organization. So at least that come to my mind right away. But now it seems like, and I believe I heard there's a report that say, you know, there's a 50-50 chance that he can be lured away specifically from the Texas teams. And you brought it up, this concept of, you know, not of going to the Spurs, but if Tim Duncan walks, you know, he's already shown that he'll take a lesser deal. And I couldn't think of a guy more willing to acquiesce to bring someone in and kind of carry the torch. You know, he'll finally play center for an entire season probably and have a guy like LaMarcus Aldridge play power forward, you know. I definitely think it could work, but I think you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, that it sounds like he's leaning more towards the Mavericks than he is the Spurs as far as the most recent reports have come out.
Yeah, I think, you know, Dallas is a real possibility. Obviously, Mark Cuban isn't afraid to go out and spend, you know, and get guys every year. He's looking to tweak the roster and get back to the playoffs. And, you know, right now, Duncan, Manu Ginobili, Danny Green, Marco Bellinelli, those guys don't have salaries for next season. So San Antonio has a lot of flexibility in the way they can structure things in order to bring in a guy like LaMarcus Aldridge, even if Duncan and Ginobili return. So that to me is kind of the most intriguing. And then obviously the torch is there for LaMarcus Aldridge. Look, I think Aldridge is an all-star talent. I don't know if he's the guy. I don't know if he's good enough to be the number one guy on a championship team, you know, without surrounding him with a couple of additional all-star talents. But, you know, he may look at his situation in Portland and say, I've done what I can. You know, we've only gotten so far, and maybe he wants a new situation. But it definitely seems like Aldridge is there for the taking, you know, for another team to come in and grab him under the right set of circumstances.
Yeah, but the funny thing about that is, and I think you touched on it, like, if he's leaving, what is he leaving for? The Wes Matthews thing really hurt them this year, because I thought they could have been where Houston was. I thought they could have been that kind of team that was a little bit of a dark horse but could have made a nice run. And once they lost Wes Matthews, they were not that team. But you look at what they've got in Portland with an aggressive GM and an owner who's, you know, Ballmer rich. Literally, I think the same company here. If you're going to Dallas, I mean, yeah, Cuban's aggressive, but is Dallas really in a better place than Portland on the court? I mean, are you improving your situation in terms of advancing in the West by going to Dallas right now over Portland?
No, I think it's safe to say no.
Yeah, it's at best a flat. I'm not sure why you do that, because it's just flat, other than, you know, he grew up in Dallas. I mean, he was born and went to high school in Dallas, so there's a real draw there for him. But I don't know. You know, to me, if, you know, like I said, Dom, we, I think, talked about this at one point, and I can't remember if it was on the podcast or just off, but it was, you know, he'll go down. If he stays, he goes down with, you know, Bill Walton and Clyde Drexler, one of the great Blazers of all time, no matter what happens. But I think he's been frustrated. He's, you know, look, in Portland, he's seen as almost the face of the franchise in a lot of ways, but outside of Portland, that's Lillard's team, you know? Even though he, you know, Aldridge goes to the All-Star games and all that, I think that he wants it, you know, it's not his team, but I don't know that, you know, look, if he goes to Dallas, it's still Dirk's team until Dirk leaves. And then, you know, again, you're going to have to bring in pieces. You know, it ain't going to be Rajon Rondo, so you've got to get a point guard and some other pieces in there in Dallas to make that work.
And it's weird because you say that, and it's like, you think about it, and all the great things he's done there, and his tenure has been, like, the first kind of part of his career there was really marred by the, you know, it was him and Brandon Roy were supposed to be the new duo, and then, you know, unfortunately, Brandon Roy's knees just couldn't keep up, and then even coinciding with that, they get the number one pick in Greg Oden, and, you know, we've got this big tandem that's supposed to, that could, you know, really put them over the top, and then Greg Oden gets hurt, and it's like all that stuff kind of clouded how good he was for all those years. And then, like you said, they actually hit in the draft and bring someone in that kind of complements him really well, and he kind of ascends to the face of the franchise, just like leapfrogs him with his playoff heroics, and you almost lose sight of that he's the crux of that team. Like you said, that could really frustrate him, and he just wants a change of scenery because, you know, things like that wear on you when you've been in the league as long as he has, and you've done what he's done, and you know, the recognition kind of keeps going by the wayside.
Well, I mean, just a couple quick things. So you talk about Aldridge being, you know, one of the all-time great Blazers. I mean, statistically, that might be true. And I'll preface this by saying it's obviously different for every franchise and how they measure their great players. You know, with a team like the Lakers, if you're not a part of a championship, you know, you can't be on that list because they have such a storied history. You know, I look at Portland. They don't make it to the finals. They don't win a championship with Aldridge there. Like, big deal. Like, so what if you're a perennial all-star? I mean, your team didn't do anything when the guy was there. And then just to look at the Dallas Mavericks situation. So it's real interesting in Dallas because they're going to most likely have an entirely different team next season. They only have three players under guaranteed contracts for next year. It's Chandler Parsons, Dirk Nowitzki, and Devin Harris. That's it. There's three guys with player options, and then they got to scramble to fill out the rest of the roster. So, you know, Tyson Chandler, unrestricted free agent, Rajon Rondo isn't coming back, you know, and then guys like Al Farouq Aminu, you know, Monte Ellis, if he opts out, you know, Dallas says, well, you're not getting a raise, so you better not opt out. So a lot of crazy stuff going on with the Mavericks roster. It's kind of tough to say whether or not he'd be in a better situation. It could be one of those deals where, you know, during the recruiting process, they're talking to multiple players. It's like we saw with the Lakers last summer with Carmelo Anthony sort of saying, hey, we're keeping all these max spots open in case we can lure more than one guy. I think you're going to see that in Dallas. They're going to be, you know, leveraging one all-star to potentially another in their recruiting pitches to try to build a contender because they got a ton of cap space and a ton of open roster spots.
Yeah, and they are interested very much in the other Texas guy as well who might go home. I don't think DeAndre Jordan is leaving the Clippers, but I think he's going to look around, and Dallas is going to be the pitch he'll really listen to.
All right, well, good stuff as always, guys. It's going to be interesting. We have the NBA draft next week, get into free agency right after that. We'll be back with you before the draft to break down, go a little bit deeper, break down some of the prospects and see where they might land later on in the first round. For Kurt Heelan, for Dominic Lidgard, I am Brett Polakoff, and we will see you next time.